Hey everybody, Cotton here. I have been working on a project called the Cotton Report, which is part news aggregator and part media publication. If you go to cottonreport.com, you'll find a nice amalgamation of the headlines, also some original articles. I would really appreciate it if y'all check it out. It is at cottonreport.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Dissecting Liberty podcast. Today we had on Pete Quinones, co-producer of the Monopoly on Violence documentary, host of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, and managing editor at the Libertarian Institute. You can find him on Twitter at Peter R. Quinones, Quinones. Enjoy the show. What gave you the idea for Monopoly on Violence?
It wasn't my idea. Chris Kofer, who is the director and editor, he came up with the idea. He approached a mutual friend of ours, Robert, and asked him about it, if he thought it was a good idea. He said, yeah, and I was the last one in on it. They approached me and said, can you help with this? It's going to be, you know, it's going to be something that people haven't seen before. It'll be original. And it'll tell the story of anarchy, and we'll do a history of anarchy. We'll talk about all sorts of different kinds. And if you would help us reach out to the people we want to interview for this, because you have a podcast, that would be great. And then help with some of the writing and whatever. And so like the first day that I was approached, I knew that I was going to be involved in reaching out to people and networking. Writing came later. That's when I realized that, I wanted to write some of the questions that we'd be asking people and things like that. So yeah, a couple months after that, we incorporated Stateless Productions. And a couple months after that, we did the very first interview at Anarchapulco 2019. Chris and Robert went down there. They interviewed Eric July, Larkin Rose, Vit Jedlicka, who didn't end up being in the movie. And there was a couple other people. And yeah, then it just took off from there. Mises University interviews, which came in July. And yeah, then we started putting the script together and I started writing narration. And yeah, man, they just asked me to, you know, did I want to be a part of this? And I was like, documentary? No idea what I'm doing. Chris used to work in Hollywood. He assured me he knew what he was doing. And I was like, yeah, let's do it, man. And I'll be honest with you. It is probably what I think is the most important yes that I've ever said in my life, because it's the thing I'm most proud of from a professional perspective.
Yeah. Next, I kind of want to touch on a concept that was mentioned in the documentary. At one point, someone said a constant state of warfare is what makes people accept infringements on our liberty. Do you think that we can enforce an end to these wars, or do you think that will only come with a collapse of the system?
I think I go back and forth on this. I was recently listening to an episode that Bob Murphy put out talking about the whole defund the police movement. And he talked about public opinion. And as much as I don't want to believe that politicians care about public opinion, now that I think about this, now that I'm going over it in my head as we're talking here, politicians do care about public opinion, but those unelected bureaucrats, the quote-unquote deep state, I mean, they obviously don't care what we think,
right?
But politicians, they can be swayed. I go back and forth on it. You know, I've recently, especially since this whole COVID stuff started, I've gone back to my roots in agorism, black markets, starving the state, not paying any taxes or paying as little taxes as possible. I think that is a very, very good strategy. And if people want to keep working politically at working on things, sure. I mean, we're not going to stop them. You know, it's like, I would never vote. I think voting is violence, but I don't know if I think voting is violence. I just think that it's really it's a violation of the non-aggression principle, because you're really looking to tell other people what to do. I mean, and of course people can make arguments about, what if it's a local tax or something like that? Sure. What if it's a local tax? Whatever. That's not what we're talking about, though. We're not talking about, you know, a tax so that somebody can build, can expand the bus line locally. We're talking about the taxes that go towards war and killing people. I don't know. I know that people are going to keep doing things politically, and I wish they wouldn't, because I think starving the state would be quicker, faster, and I think it would turn people around towards our way of thinking quicker. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's, I don't know, man, that war, it's, you know, Randolph Bourne, war is the health of the state. And yeah, it just really feels like not every state. Switzerland's not a warlike state. You know, there are states that aren't at war, but man, this state is just, it just seems to have hint has, I was, and it was funny as you asked this question, I was thinking about this before we were going on, and it seems like it just, everything hinges upon dropping bombs right now. And it's, you know, it's sickening.
Yeah. You have to wonder if the world empire, which is the US, can actually if it can de-escalate from that, like if it could actually become more of a peaceful state, like let's say you brought up Switzerland. I don't know. It's once you're on top, I don't know if you can actually come down from that without actually collapsing. You know what I mean?
Or just, yeah. Because, you know, you think about how some people, like professionally, like rock stars or something like that, they're at the top of their game, and then, you know, you're going to come back down. There's no way. You know, there's a reason why the term one hit wonder is out there. And usually when they come down and they come off that high, a lot of them end up crashing and burning, and, you know, really their lives become destroyed. And there is a really good chance that if the United States would be forced to pull back militarily, I think that if it was if 90% or 50% of the population just demanded, stop these wars, we're not going to pay our taxes, we're not going to vote for you guys, that things could, it would be easier. But I mean, just them forcing them falling into their own footprint and everything collapsing. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be good for a lot of people. And I really think people really should be getting prepared for that, because I don't know how much they have left, but libertarians have been saying that for 50 years. So.
Yeah.
I have a question related to that. Relative to history, the American government has grown incredibly quickly. Why do you think that is?
I think the Constitution was put together by a bunch of businessmen who were cronies and were trying to protect their business. I just put out an episode with Patrick Newman, assistant professor at Florida Southern College, Mises Institute fellow, and he's writing a book now on crony capitalism in the colonies. I mean, he's starting in the early 1600s until, I think he's going up through the Mexican-American War, which would be 1846, 1848. You just look and you see that crony capitalism dominated right from the start. Mm-hmm. Hamilton said, we have to go into debt in order. Basically, the argument he's making is we have to go into debt so that people will take us seriously on the international stage, on the international stage, because that's what nations do. And once, and especially when you started seeing wars of conquest to gain land, like the Mexican-American War, and then you go up into the early 1900s, and you have the forays into the Philippines and Cuba, everything, there was just no way to stop it from there. I think it was just the cronyism right from the start. Just the whole thought was, okay, how are these elites, how are we going to make money? And one of the easiest ways to do that is to just perpetuate war. And yeah, I mean, when you really look at it and you look at the little skirmishes and everything that happened in American history, there are very few years that the United States wasn't doing something warlike. Yeah, I mean, War of 1812, they tried to seize Florida and Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, that's 21 years after the Constitution was ratified in 1789, really. You know, it's 21 years after Washington is inaugurated. I mean, it's mind-boggling, man. It's just wars of conquest right from the start. You know, people are, oh, we need to go back to the Constitution. No, we need to scrap that thing altogether. that thing is horrifying. Don't make me quote Spooner.
Well, getting back to the documentary, what is one piece of advice that you would give to someone who's looking into making a documentary of their own?
You're going to need a lot of money.
Yeah.
you're going to need a lot of money. We underestimated how much money we were going to need. We thought that because Chris was going to be directing and editing this on his own, and that Vinnie Marshall would help with that, you know, we thought that we could do this for $15,000, and thankfully people just kept giving after, and it brought us up to $25,000, $26,000, and all that money's gone. We had to use it for travel. There are other people that I specifically myself wanted to interview for the documentary that just didn't make it because we just ran out of money.
Yeah.
And there were other topics. There were other topics we wanted to really talk about, but there were a couple topics where we wanted an additional voice in there. You know, like this wasn't a money issue, this was something different, but the first 7 minutes of the documentary is basically James C. Scott. Now,
yeah,
James C. Scott's a hero. The guy's amazing. I mean, the fact that he gave us the time is, we can't thank him enough. Mm-hmm. But we wanted David Graeber, who's a left anarchist. Yeah, I don't know if James C. Scott would consider himself a right anarchist, but he's definitely doesn't have that whole left anarchist vibe. David Graeber, who's over in London, we approached him about interviewing him because we had a contact in London who had the same kind of equipment and setup that we did. So they would have went, and you know, then you just put it on the drive, put it on Dropbox, easy.
Yeah.
And we had emails going back and forth with Graeber, and it just didn't work out, and just the emails stopped and everything. So we wanted if there's a subject there where it seems like one person maybe talking a little bit too much, we wanted other people. And that goes back to money. That goes back to, if you're going to do a documentary, one, I would say somebody in the crew has to have experience with the equipment and everything. If you're not going in this with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars where you can actually hire a crew. If you're going to do this, if you're going to do it yourself, if it's going to be a DIY documentary, somebody's going to have the experience. And Chris having that experience of being able to teach Robert helped a lot. And then having Vinny be a part of the crew and him being out in San Francisco and being able to get Thaddeus Russell and David Friedman, he also had equipment. So, yeah, it's money. You have to figure out beforehand who you want to interview, figure out where they're going to be, how much travel is going to be, because remember, you're also traveling with equipment.
Yeah.
So you're going to be spending extra money to ship that equipment, you know, put that equipment on the plane too. So yeah, that's, I would say, if you think you have a good idea and you're working with someone who knows what they're doing as far as equipment goes, it's just money, man. It all come pretty much yeah. in any kind of endeavor, it's all going to come back to your funding. And we appreciate everyone who gave $10. I mean, a bunch of people gave $10, $30. I think, you know, we had a $100 level and a $500 level. And at one point it was like, there were more people who had given at the $100 level and the $10 level.
Wow.
So, I mean, that was really, that made us that much more motivated, because we knew that people wanted to see this. So, you know, I mean, I can just hope, just judging from the feedback I've gotten, it doesn't seem like anybody who donated to the project is complaining. And we've had had a couple of people complain here and there, but I mean, come on, it's libertarianism. What the hell?
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Related to that, what have the responses been to the documentary?
Overwhelmingly positive. I would say over 99%. I mean, you can judge off of thumbs up and thumbs down on YouTube. And I think, you know, thumbs down might be in the little over 1% at this point or something like that. But as far as people talking about it, you know, Tom Woods saying that he was absolutely floored by it, that really helped a lot, because
yeah,
the people we asked to interview, they had no idea what we were doing. And we just told them, it's like, hey, we're doing a documentary on anarchism, and you know, a big concentration of it is going to be anarcho-capitalism. And they're like, sure, you know, well, yeah, sure. So the response from the people who are in it has been more important to me than anything. And everyone I've talked to who's in it, who's seen it, has been enormously positive and overwhelmingly positive. And even people saying that they were just shocked that it went beyond their wildest dreams.
Yeah. Well, next question. What was your favorite interview?
Oh, Judge Napolitano, Andrew yeah. Napolitano, because we weren't supposed to get him.
Yeah.
I mean, we hadn't, you know, I would say like 2 weeks before Mises University last summer, which was in July, you know, we had cinched up probably 8 of the lecturers, and Jeff Dice wasn't lecturing, but he agreed. I didn't even talk to Ryan McMakin. When I got there, Ryan McMakin, I asked him, and you know, he came up there and he was able to, he did very well, and he's prominent in the documentary. But you know, just being able to, because Judge Napolitano teaches at Mises University every year, he's usually there from Monday through Friday, and going down and asking him and just going, look, you know, we're shooting a documentary, Mises Institute's letting us do it upstairs, we're all set up, can you come up and answer some questions? You know, we want to keep them focused on constitutional issues.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a couple questions, he had a couple concerns that I was able to overcome, and you know, they were easy to overcome. And yeah, he came up there and I just started firing off questions to him. Now, remember, when you asked me that question, what's my favorite interview? I'm giving you my favorite interview that I actually did, yeah, that I was the one asking the questions. So yeah, so it was Judge Knapp. I mean, obviously I did the questions for Dave Smith and Jeff Deist and everyone at that Mises Institute event. And so, you know, the only reason I'm putting Judge Knapp above anybody else is because it was unexpected. So, but as far as interviews of people who just absolutely nailed it, I mean, I don't think that Thaddeus Russell, I don't know if anybody, you know, short of John Taylor Gatto, could have done as well talking about the education system as Thaddeus Russell did. I mean, he just knocked that out of the park. I mean, and that's what Tom Wood said. Holy crap, Thaddeus. He's like, yeah, that part, the part on education is just amazing. And I was like, yeah, man, you know, Vinny did really well. Vinny did really well on that, that interview. So, yeah, I was very happy about that, that that came out. But, you know, it's kind of asking me what my favorite interview in there is, like, you know, sort of asking me, you
know, yeah.
Yeah. Which of my brothers I like more.
Yeah.
Well, that's an easy pick, but anyway.
Well, a quick aside before we get to the next question. When I first watched the documentary, I was sitting there with my fiance and Dave Smith came up on the screen and he's like basically my hero because he brought me into anarchism. And I'm sitting there and I gasp.
And she, was she like, what kind of weird, what kind of weird yeah. Is this, you know?
Yeah, she was. Huh,
you're not supposed to do that for dudes.
Yeah, she was looking at her phone and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. That was, you know, just kind of my hero there. So
it's funny.
So with the documentary, what's one thing that fell through?
That we couldn't do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I already mentioned it is getting David Graeber, who is one of the premier anthropologists in the world. Yeah. I mean, guy run out of academia in the United States. I mean, he's an American. I mean, he's from New York. He went to the same high school as my parents. Yeah. He went to the same grade school and high school as my parents. I mean, he's a New Yorker. Wow. And they ran him out of academia, American academia, so much so that he lives in London now. You know, so to have been able to have, you know, what's the name of his book? Taxes, the First 5,000 Years or something like that. I can't remember the exact name, but just to be able to, just to have had another voice in the beginning when you're really going through over history, like James C. Scott was doing, not that James C. Scott didn't do an amazing job. I mean, the guy's phenomenal, but that's one thing that I wish. I wish we would have had had an offsetting voice there.
Yeah, and I remember at one point I saw you tweet and you were asking about people that lived in Europe who could maybe go interview Hans Hermann Hoppe.
That's actually wrong.
Oh, okay.
I wanted somebody to go interview Prince Hans Adams in Liechtenstein.
Oh, okay.
Now, I didn't nail him down. I didn't nail him down or anything. And it would have been really, it might have been difficult. I would have had to probably go through the Mises Institute and have them contact Hoppe and then have Hoppe contact him because Hoppe knows him. But yeah, that was who I wanted. That was my idea. But like, that was for like a solid month. I was like, I want to get Hans Adams. I want to get Hans Adams. Yeah. I want to get Hans Adams. Then it was like, then I like priced, like if I flew there to interview him and I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen. and then we started. So I was talking to somebody who knew a film crew over there in Germany and they wanted more than what it would have cost me to fly over there. So I was just like, I guess we're not going to get him. But yeah, hey. What can you do? There's friends of mine that I wanted to be in there that I didn't get. So,
yeah.
But I mean, it still turned out phenomenal, you know? Like, I mean, it sucks that you weren't able to get all the interviews you wanted, but I mean, damn, it's still really good.
Yeah. Thank you. And looking at it now, the way it's structured and everything, really don't want to change anything. So, it's just one of those things you're looking back and you're like, hey, how would we have done this differently? But the overwhelming positive response is enough. So, you know, Jimmy Morrison, who did the Bubble documentary, which I think is a great documentary. I actually went to New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to New York to go to the premiere for that. He told Chris, because he was giving us advice the whole time, and he was actually at the Mises Institute for Mises U for a couple of days. He said, whatever you do, make sure that when you look at this 10 years from now, you'll be proud of it. And that was probably the most important piece of advice, because then that takes away all the, oh, I wish I could have talked to this guy. I wish I could have talked to this guy. No, let's make what we have the best. and, you know, work with that.
Yeah. One thing that I really appreciated about the documentary was that you did a lot to explain the history of anarchism and not just the, right anarchism, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, there was no such thing as right anarchism when it, you know, originated.
Correct.
And, so I just appreciated that you did a lot to explain it without it becoming like an ANCAP, autism documentary. Right.
Well, I mean, how can you talk about the history of anarchism without mentioning Proudhon, Bakunin, even Stirner, Tucker? And yeah, I must say that whole section that goes over the history of anarchism, that was exclusively done by Bryce Peterson and Vinnie Marshall. They put that together. They did it and then sent it to us. That was their creativity. You know, we just told them what we wanted, and they went far beyond where, you know, going back 2,000, 3,000 years, talking about the Orient, things like that. I mean, that was better than what actually we had written. So we're very appreciative for that part, because I can even see in the future that part just being taken out on its own and people sending it to other people as a, you know, some kind of training tool.
Yeah.
So back to like some stuff that was discussed in the documentary. Do you think that people have a cultural or intellectual block when it comes to secession?
I don't know, man. In the last few months, I've changed my mind on secession a lot. I don't know how it would get done at this point. I mean, it's the block is both political and cultural.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. From a standpoint, when you mention secession to the left, they immediately bring up slavery because that's their training. When you bring up secession to the right, it's the union.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, this is the way it's supposed to be. It's like, well, I mean, you realize the country was founded on secession.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what those guys, you realize it was part of Great Britain and then they broke off and they were actually willing to be a part of Great Britain still as long as they could have autonomy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't work out. So yeah, it's that old meme of, if you hate secession, what are you celebrating every July 4th?
Yeah.
So that's from the right. And then from the left, it's just, you know, I'm fully convinced that the whole argument about cultural political is starting to fade. And now it is one side wanting to control the reins to punish the other.
Yeah.
And that's what I see. You know, I mean, and their fringes, it's really loud Twitter voices. Let's face it. I mean, the loudest minority pushes culture. You've seen that throughout that's the whole premise of Thaddeus Russell's book, Renegade History of the United States, is that minorities with loud voices and boisterous, they push culture.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that's where we are right now, where, you know, nobody would want secession. I mean, I forget it was Malice or Smith said it recently, but said, I forget who the fuck it was, but why would the left have a problem with Richard Spencer and his 10 people that follow him going and starting some ethno state and splitting off from them? Why would you want those people around you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they want to leave, let them, you know, why do they have to leave the country? I mean, they can go, you know, it's like the whole Randy Weaver thing. You know, I think a race war is coming, so I'm going to go a half hour from the Canadian border up in Idaho in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they followed him up there. I mean, he wasn't planning to be a part of the war. He wasn't planning to invade anything. But no, as long as people think and worship differently than you, then the state, then the approved methods, well, then you need to be killed. See Waco six months later.
Yeah. And a lot of, like, so we're talking about secession. We're talking about this need for people to control others. And like, we all know that a lot of that comes from the public school system. When you're talking to people about public education or public schooling, rather, what is your go-to when it comes to describing that and trying to sway them against it?
Well, I always call it government schooling. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I just lead off with. And I just asked people, would you rather have your kid in a government school or a private school? And even though private schools in this country their curriculum has to be mandated by the state, not all of it, but there's a core part. I went to private school. There's a core part. I think that's a good way to start asking. I mean, I think I read in California, it's like every government school student, it costs like $30,000 a year. It's like the premier prep schools in Atlanta where I live are $20,000 a year. You just give that parent the money and have them send them to Wesleyan here. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, when you start breaking numbers down with people, that also helps. You know, when you say, you know, how come you don't send your kid to Wesleyan? Well, it's $20,000 a year. Yeah, but it costs the state $22,000 to educate your kid in public school.
Yeah.
When you tell them that, they're just like, wait, what? I mean, some people are open to it. And some people may just sense your position because they're sick of the conversation. And they just want to get out of there. But, you know, I mean, I think most people know they don't want their kids in a government. If they had their way, their kid wouldn't be in a government school. I don't know too many people who can afford to send their kids to a $20,000 a year school who don't. You know, so I think most parents out there whose kids are in government schools would in a heartbeat send them to a private school if they could afford it. Yeah. And of course, private school, like I said, private school is not the best thing. I mean, I would rather have unschooling or homeschooling, and gone are the days when 14, 15-year-old kid would go apprentice on a job so that in a couple years he'd be ready to do the job and get paid like an adult.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, for me personally, even though I went to private school, that would have been much better for me. It would have been way better for me because in my last 2 years of high school, I just did enough to get by because I didn't want to be there.
Right.
It was boring to me. It didn't make any sense. I asked my dad when I turned 16, I said, can you give me permission to drop out so I can get GED? And my dad, being my dad, said, absolutely not. So I had to stay in school until and graduate. But I mean, I didn't want to be there. It was just, it wasn't doing anything for me. I mean, really, think about your junior and senior high school. What are you using in your daily life, in your life at all, that you learned then?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless you were in, I took a bunch of business courses that I don't really use. I mean, I did for a while there, but, it wasn't like it was directly applicable. I still had to learn other stuff. I mean, it just doesn't. I mean, I think that people can learn on their own. I've told people this. When I went to kindergarten, when I was 5 years old, I could read the newspaper. Why? Because my parents taught me at home. I mean, when I was 5 years old, I could read the newspaper. Yeah. Anything in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked at that point, I only wanted to read the sports section, but I mean, I could read, I was one of those kids who was 5 years old and you could have a conversation with.
Yeah. You
know, that I don't know how, I'm not around kids now, so I don't know how rare that is, but I would hope it's not rare. I would hope parents are teaching at home, but you know, also when I was that age, my dad worked. So
yeah,
my mom could work with me. And there's your, you know, also your whole thing about the Federal Reserve just absolutely destroying wealth and making it so that two parents, unless one of the parents is overwhelmingly successful as an insanely good paying job, then both parents are going to have to work. And that really takes it out of, takes away the whole teaching thing at home.
So we have just about 5 minutes left. I have one more question, and then when you're finished with that, go ahead and give your plugs. Who is your favorite? Or no, I'm sorry. You recently left the LP. Can you give your case for why other people should, or why it's not the best avenue to liberty?
I don't know. I will, but I don't want to seem like I'm like one of those people who, you know, is like, hey, people really need to do what they want. I would just say that I think that from my study for the last 12 years of my life, I think agorism is the most liberating individually.
Yeah.
On an individual basis, and working within the system, you know, not only the questions about the non-aggression principle and voting and things like that, I just don't see it being moving the needle. Now, I think the whole, people like to bring up the Ron Paul thing, but they conveniently leave out that, you know, Ron Paul ran as a Republican.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he could get on, him getting on the debate stage when half the country, or even more than half the country, are watching, that's important. This year, with the whole COVID-19 thing, I knew immediately when I saw what was coming down, what they were doing with that, that there wasn't going to be a political solution to that.
Right.
And I also saw with all the shutdowns and everything that, I mean, even if you did, even if, you know, Rand Paul or, you know, or somebody, if Ron decided to run as the LP, run in the LP and got the nomination, they weren't going to let him talk. There was going to be any kind of debate that he was going to get in, that he could show his thing. I mean, at this point, who knows? I think the debates are probably going to happen online. And I don't know. It just, going back and reading Konkin's An Agorist Primer and the New Libertarian Manifesto, just books I read 5 years ago, just didn't hit me 5 years ago, even though I've been an agorist the whole time. Really started to speak to me because of the environment, the political environment that was happening. So, I mean, Donnie Gebert jokes that, you know, well, just, we need to go there and stand out there and have an agorist, you know, get an agorist wing, start an agorist wing of the Libertarian Party, where you're just like, oh, wait a minute, we can't be part of a party and be the agorist. This is ridiculous. Yeah. And I just don't look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump got elected on a message of bring the troops home, audit the Fed. People forget about that. He said he was going to audit the Fed, and he got in there, and they, at every turn, I mean, and this is a Republican running as a Republican, elected as a Republican. They did everything to stop him. There's nothing's going to happen inside the system. Nothing's going to be solved inside the system. It's going to have to happen from the outside. And I think agorism is really the only nonviolent approach.
Well, all right, man. Give your plugs.
All right. Go to themonopolyonviolence.com. You'll see there on the home page that we have a link to the documentary on YouTube. There is a free 720 link download, a 720 download link there. You can download it. Right next to it, there's a link to donate. Because, like I said, we didn't make any money off of this, and we're not going to sell it. We're going to keep it. So Amazon's not going to pay us to put it up there. If it gets on Netflix, we're not going to get paid to do that. So we're putting that money towards starting our next project and some of the promotion for this one, like film festivals and things like that. So if you want to donate, please do. And there's also a 4K version that you can download for $10 there. We also have a bunch of Stateless Production merchandise, and there's a movie poster. I have to order my movie poster. I haven't even gotten it yet. So, yeah, we got all that. TheMonopolyOnViolence.com.
Hey, everybody. We are in this super awesome, dope-ass group of podcasts called The Frat House, which includes
Burning Boots, Punk Rock Libertarians, Dissecting Liberty, Anarchy Proper, The Gaslight Hour, Sean V. Planet, The Dose, Erase the State, No Real Libertarian, Trent Must Talk, Unshackled Liberty, Laurel and Hardy Across the Pond, and Insurrection, Inc.
And you can find them all at frathousepodcasts.com.